Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
This past weekend, my family and I had the privilege of going camping with eight other families from Living Waters for our annual Young Families camping trip. We headed up to Golden Ears Park for two nights of camping, and we had a wonderful, wonderful time. If you've never had the chance of going camping with 21 children and 17 adults, most of those children being preschool age or younger, I would have to say that you're missing out. There's a freedom that comes in camping with families who are at the same stage of their children as you are, as I am. We didn't have to worry about our children waking up in the middle of the night and crying, because the odds were pretty good that every family at some point that night were going to have a child awake and crying. So we didn't have to worry about that. And the kids had a blast together. They built forts in the forest. Some of the dads, some of the more irresponsible dads, built a swing, a rope swing for the kids. And we had brought a wagon. And the wagon, we brought it because we wanted to help people transport their stuff from their vehicles over to where we were camping. But what happens when you bring a child's wagon and there happens to be a large hill on the campsite and you have a bunch of kids is, well, the result is similar to the Olympic sport of bobsled. But the kids had a blast, and I know many of you were praying for us as we went, and we had a great time. There's no major injuries, only minor injuries of cuts and scrapes, mostly from the rope swing. And the only other injuries were from when the adults decide that they want to participate in the bobsled-like. So small wagon, big adult, big hill, injuries happen, but that's okay. Nothing major. This morning, I want us to keep in mind that perspective is important. Being a young family, camping with other young families, is wonderful, if that's your perspective. However, if you're the middle-aged couple who happens to be camping beside the 21 children who are crying in the night, yelling on this rope swing, and screaming down the hill on the wagon, your analysis might be a little bit different. Your relaxing getaway to the mountains may not be what you had intended. So today we're going to spend some time in the book of Esther. You can feel free to turn there now. I always have a hard time finding Esther, so I'll give you a little bit of direction here. Esther is after Nehemiah, and it's before Job, and Job is before the book of Psalms. So the book of Psalms is fairly easy to find. It's a big one in the middle. Just go ahead and you'll find Job, and ahead a little more and you'll find Esther. So Esther is written from a different perspective. Most of the books of the Bible that were written at this time were written from the perspective of the Israelites, the Jewish people, trying and hoping and in the process of returning to Jerusalem. But Esther is different. It is written from the perspective of being able to return to Jerusalem, but choosing not to. In addition to that, the book of Esther has no apparent concern for the law, and in the book, there isn't even one tiny miracle. In fact, if you were to flip through the book of Esther right now, the 10 chapters, you will not even find a mention of God. A very different perspective indeed. In the book of Esther, good triumphs, evil is destroyed, and all ends happily. It's like a perfect fairy tale with all the twists and turns that come with it. However, beneath that lighthearted surface, the book of Esther explores a few darker themes. Racial hatred, the threat of genocide, and the evil of pride and vanity. The book of Esther is set in the Jewish diaspora of the Persian Empire during the reign of King Xerxes. The Book of Esther is a beautifully written book. I don't have time to go into all the details, and all the details aren't really important for us this morning. But the author of the book does a masterful job of presenting so much of the book in pairs. So there are pairs of banquets. There are pairs of people going before the king. There are two groups of noblemen. There are two meetings. There are two decrees. There's even a two-day celebration. Everything happens in pairs. The book also includes something called ironic reversal. Throughout the book, the expected outcome is reversed. Queens become banished. Orphan girls become queens. Powerful men are humbled. And humble men become powerful. More on this later, but even the Jews' mourning becomes rejoicing. I mention that because there is a lesson right off the top, even before we get to the character that we're going to study today. The lesson to the Jews through the Book of Esther and to us is that the status quo is never such. It's not status quo. Things can always change. It's a good lesson for us. To understand the book, and therefore God's message through the Book of Esther, we need to understand some of the history and the geopolitical issues surrounding the times that the book takes place. Back in 586 BC, I know some of you are rolling your eyes already. Oh, he's throwing out dates. Stick with me. Back in 586 BC, the Jews of Judah and Jerusalem were carried into exile by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar when he sacked the city of Jerusalem and burnt the temple. This exile of the Israelites being forced out of their homes and to other places is a fulfillment of the punishment promised in Deuteronomy 28 for disobedience. The destruction of Jerusalem was the fulfillment of the covenant curse for the disobedience and sin of the people. Because of this, God scattered the Israelites among the nations. It was during this time that God's people came to be called Jews. The name was taken from the name of their homeland, Judah. This diaspora, or scattering, was not a small issue for the Jewish people. The destruction of the temple in Jerusalem signaled the end of the glory of ancient Israel. Without the temple, without the sacrifices, without the priesthood, without the monarchy, God's people could not function as he had commanded. New religious practices replaced those that had disappeared with the destruction of the temple. Exilic Judaism centered on the study of the Torah, the Holy Scriptures, because the sacred scrolls could go wherever God's people found themselves. But God's people didn't live in complete despair, because God had promised that a remnant would one day return to Jerusalem. That promise is found in Jeremiah 30. This return to the homeland happened in part due to Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon and the Babylonian Empire without even a battle. That's impressive. He invaded Babylon while King Belshazzar was engaged in drunken revelry. You may remember that story. Hopefully it sends some ideas to you from your memory of the book of Daniel. We find the story of that happening in Daniel chapter 5. The Persian Empire, which now replaced the Babylonian Empire, stretched from modern Pakistan to modern Turkey and down to modern Sudan. The Persian Empire ruled in the ancient East for 200 years until Alexander the Great conquered Persia in 330 BC. Cyrus played an important role in biblical history. He's mentioned in the Bible in Ezra chapter 1 and in Isaiah chapters 44 and 45. Cyrus is the one who ushered in the end of the exile. Cyrus was the one who allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem and to begin to rebuild the temple. And not just rebuild the temple on their own, but actually rebuild the temple using Persian resources. The book of Esther tells a story of a Jewish people who, about 50 years after Cyrus allowed them to go home, they had apparently chosen not to return to the homeland. So the Bible focuses our attention to what is happening in Jerusalem at the time. But there are some amazing things happening in the broader world at the same time. For example, Confucius, the Chinese philosopher, was born at a similar time in the Far East. To the west of Palestine, Greece was reaching its golden age. Pericles was shaping a political system in Athens that would become the basis of modern democracy. Sophocles, the playwright, was writing Oedipus Rex, and probably reading it afterwards too. Aristophanes was writing the great Greek comedies. And during the same century as Esther, Socrates was born. Pythagoras was establishing the Pythagorean theorem, which says A squared plus B squared equals... Well done! Bunch of mathematicians here. And finally, also in Greece, the Olympic Games were establishing their roots as a great test of athleticism. And in the midst of all that was happening in the geopolitical scene, we find a man named Mordecai. God seems to work in unlikely places through seemingly insignificant events. So we know a few things about Mordecai. First is that he was a Jew from the tribe of Benjamin. And he was living in one of the capitals of the Persian Empire, named Susa. We also know that Mordecai was a descendant of Kish, who is a distant descendant of Saul, a former king of Israel. Mordecai presumably had spent his life in the Persian Empire. If he had ever seen Jerusalem, it was either when he was a very young child or if he had been sent there on the king's business. As I mentioned before, this means that Mordecai has no experience in participating in the temple rituals. Instead, he has experienced God through traditions that were held by the Jewish people. Mordecai would have also experienced God through the study of the Torah. Now, depending on the teachers that Mordecai might have had, his experience may not have been much of an experience at all. Mordecai also seems to hold some sort of position within the king's court in the capital of Susa. We don't know what that position is at the start of the book of Esther. Some commentators guess at everything from a judge or a magistrate. Some guess that he was an accountant. And some guess that he was part of the king's personal guards. But regardless of the position, Mordecai is a foreigner who has been able to integrate or assimilate enough into the society of the Persian culture to be trusted to serve in the capital city. Mordecai also has a cousin whose name was Hadassah, who was an orphan. So Mordecai welcomed his cousin Hadassah into his own home and raised her as his own daughter. Hadassah was also known as Esther. Mordecai has been living his life as a Persian, but as a descendant of the Jewish people. But things are about to change drastically for Mordecai. So, there are four main characters in the book of Esther. I take my pictures very seriously. They are true renderings of what they looked like. There is Esther, who becomes queen. There is Xerxes, who is the ruler or king of the Persian Empire. There's Mordecai, who we just talked about. And there's Haman, who spends some time as prime minister or second in command in the Persian Empire. We have these four main characters. The book of Esther starts out innocently enough. It starts out as once upon a time in a land far, far away. Okay, it's not quite like that. But it's close enough. It starts out with King Xerxes having a party. Simple enough. During that party, the king orders the queen at the time to come to him so that he can show her off to all his guests at the party because she is so beautiful. Well, the queen refuses. I wonder why. In response, Xerxes banishes the queen, and he begins a search for a new queen. In this, Esther, Mordecai's cousin, becomes part of this reality TV show-esque competition to become queen. And through accepting wise advice and using her charm and beauty, Esther wins the heart of Xerxes and becomes queen. There's an interesting comment made in Esther chapter 2, verse 10, that says that Mordecai directed her not to reveal that she was a Jew. Interesting. So that has a whole bunch of implications. That means she's not following some of the laws. She's not following the dietary restrictions. And Mordecai tells her to conceal that information. Esther continues that cover-up after she becomes queen. We also find out that Mordecai continues to gain trust by becoming a palace official. And Esther continues to honor Mordecai by following his directions. So one day, Mordecai is working, and he overhears a plot to assassinate the king. I think he must have good hearing. Mordecai then reports this to Queen Esther, and she informs the king, giving credit back to Mordecai. So the king's life is saved. And life continues on just fine until King Xerxes promotes a man named Haman, who is an Agagite. Now, the Agagite part might be one that you skim over. It means nothing. Well, don't skim over it. It's important. It's in there for a reason. So who was Agag? And why is his name so hard to pronounce? Agag, of whom Haman is a descendant, was king of the Amalekites. He was king of the Amalekites at the same time that Saul was king of the Israelites. So you have these two kings, Agag, king of Amalekites, Saul, king of Israel. And who is Agag's descendant? Haman. And who is Saul's descendant? Mordecai and Esther. So you have some pre-existing stuff going on here. Let's take a step even further back. Trivia question for you. Who were the first people to attack the Israelites after they came into the Promised Land? The Amalekites. The plot thickens. So the Amalekites are the first to attack the Israelites after they go into the Promised Land. Because of that, God had promised in Exodus 17 that he would completely erase the memory of the Amalekites from under heaven and would be at war with them from generation to generation. We come back to the time of King Saul, and King Saul had been ordered to attack Agag and completely annihilate both Agag and the Amalekites. Don't keep their livestock, don't spare the people. Obliterate them. And did Saul do what God commanded? Kind of. And that's the problem. He attacks them. He beats them. He wins the battle. But he doesn't annihilate them. He spares the life of Agag. And he keeps some of the livestock, the best livestock, for himself. Back to the book of Esther. The king's officials are supposed to bow down to Haman in respect. But Mordecai decides that he will not make the same mistake as his ancestor Saul. And he refuses to bow down and show respect to Haman. Upon hearing this, Haman, who seems to have some understanding of the past history between these two peoples himself, decides to take advantage of the situation, and it is decided after casting lots, called Purim, that the Jews in the Persian Empire would be annihilated. They would all be killed. Well, Mordecai is devastated. I'm sure the questions of, what have I done? I'm sure the question of, God, I was trying to honor you through this, and look what has happened, are swirling in Mordecai's head. So Mordecai makes Esther aware of the decree. And he asks her in the most famous passage in the book to take action. Haman, not knowing the relationship between Esther and Mordecai, attends two of Esther's banquets, while his plot is found out. Haman ends up being the one that's executed using the device that he had intended on executing Mordecai on. Another case of ironic reversal. The king then learns about the relationship between Queen Esther and Mordecai. And Mordecai is brought into a position of even more power in the kingdom. Powerful men are humbled, and humble men become powerful. The plot to annihilate the Jews is overthrown, and rather the Jews annihilate their enemies. The Jews' mourning is turned into rejoicing. Mordecai then sends a letter throughout the Persian Empire, calling on the Jews to celebrate on the 2 days that they were to be annihilated by having feasts and by giving food and presents to each other and to the poor. This celebration is still held today, and it's known as the Festival of Purim, the Festival of Lots. So when faced with the question or the thought of God using us, many of us will ask the question, who? Me? And I'm sure that Mordecai was no different. Here is a man who is growing up in a foreign land that did not respect or understand the Jews' form of worship. Mordecai was a man who had not experienced the presence of, the God who he had been taught to worship. And Mordecai was a man who was far from perfect. Many of us find ourselves in similar territory. Each of us lives maybe not in a foreign land, but in a culture that struggles to understand the God we worship. Some of us may feel like we have not experienced the presence of God ever, or at least for a long time. And all of us, every single person in this room, is far from perfect. Hate to break it to you. And yet God chooses the Mordecais, the Esthers, the Bobs, the Franks, the Susies, the Ryans. God chooses them to reveal himself to the people around them. So let's take a look at Mordecai and the whys and hows of God's movement in his life. Mordecai has several admirable qualities that he has going for him. Mordecai thought of others first. We see several examples of this. The first time we see this is when Mordecai brings Esther into his own home. Her parents have died. She's an orphan. And Mordecai thinks about her and says, how would I want to be treated? I would want somebody to bring me in. And so he does that. We also see this in Mordecai's life when his life is threatened. When Mordecai goes to Esther, his first thoughts are not about his own life, but about the lives of the Jewish people. Second, Mordecai allowed and trusted God to work out the details in his personal life. I will tell you this, if I uncovered a plot to assassinate a well-known person, I would be looking for some rewards, some good PR, perhaps. But Mordecai doesn't. He goes about his life, seemingly trusting that God is going to look after the details in God's time. Third, Mordecai seemed to be dominated by a sense of mission. Although Mordecai had never been able to worship at the temple, he had never been able to experience the presence of God in his life, he knew that God had acted in the past. And that meant that God could very well act in his life as well. This is somewhat ironic, as so much of the book of Esther is, in that Mordecai could have returned to Jerusalem, but had chosen not to. For some reason, circumstances and God's hand were keeping Mordecai exactly where he was. But even though he was staying in the Persian capital of Susa, Mordecai acted to ensure that he and all other Jewish people retained their Jewish identity and remembered who was actually in control. Fourth, Mordecai realized that the story was not about him as an individual, and it wasn't about Esther. The story was about God. Mordecai knew that the Jewish people were to be God's people among the world, and Mordecai strived to ensure that they would be able to continue to do so. I mentioned earlier that God is not mentioned anywhere in the book of Esther. That seems a little strange, doesn't it? Here you have a book in God's word that doesn't mention God. Imagine writing a letter to someone to describe yourself, but you never actually mention yourself. Is this a problem? I don't see it as a problem in the book of Esther at all. In fact, I see it as a brilliant way of writing. When you read the book of Esther, you just assume that God is a part and pervasive in every detail of the story. It's a brilliant way of writing. So Mordecai's life is a great example of how we can live, even when we were in a place that seems a little difficult or unusable by God. May I challenge you today to live as Mordecai did, so that we can reflect who God is to the world around us? Let's personalize that challenge that we see in Mordecai. First, the status quo is never such. There is no status quo. Change is always possible. If you find yourself in an uncomfortable place today that looks like you are unable to get out of, this is for you. With God, things can always change. I can speak to this in my own life. Things can always change. And as I look around this room, there are dozens of other people that can tell stories from their own lives as well. Things can always change. Second, let's think of others first. Our society tells us that we should put ourselves first, and if there happens to be anything left over, then we can think about others. Let's not do that. Let's be generous. Let's live out what we see in Mordecai and what's taught by Jesus in Matthew chapter 7, where it says, "Do to others whatever you would like them to do to you." Let's think of others first. Third, let's trust and allow God to work out the personal details in our lives. We love to be in control, don't we? I love to be in control. I love to be able to plan my life and to plan backup situations in case my first preference doesn't take place. I love to have it all neat and tidy and in a box and planned out perfectly. Let's work on giving the control to God and allowing Him to look after things. Mordecai didn't demand reward for saving the king's life, but God knew what had happened. And Mordecai's reward was on its way, with better timing than Mordecai could have ever imagined. So let us remember today that God knows what we have done. And let's receive our rewards in His timing, because it will be much better in His timing than if we demand it today. Fourth, let's be dominated by a sense of mission. God has placed us where we are, and He has created us the way we are for a purpose. Let's not let that go to waste. Let's use what God has given and let Him be known to those around us. You know, I think about Jordan talking about chopping wood. No, God's created you, Jordan, exactly the way you are. And the camp happened in Haida Gwaii because you can chop wood and set up tents. That needed to happen. Every single person in this room has gifts that God has given to them. Let's use them. And let's use them so that God is revealed to those who are around us. Oh yeah. Remember that you're not too sinful. Remember Mordecai is the one who told Esther, don't tell anybody you're a Jew. Don't follow those laws. But you know what God did? He used even that. And so God wants to use you exactly the way you are. The way that you are right now, today. Fifth, let's remember that the story isn't about us. Mordecai says to Esther, "Who knows if perhaps you were made queen for such a time as this?" Mordecai assumes that the story is not being written by him or by Esther, nor is the story about him or Esther. Mordecai realizes that God is writing the story, and the story is about God. So this morning in Fort Langley, do you realize that you are not the center of the story? Sorry. God wants to use you, and He wants to bless you, but the story isn't about you. It's about God. If you go back to our Story Sundays, you will see that the stories that are shared involve the circumstances of those who are sharing, but the stories aren't actually about the people. The stories are about God and who God is. So what is your story about? Is it about you? Or is it about God? So thank you for journeying with me this morning through the book of Esther and the person of Mordecai. I've always found Mordecai fascinating and challenging, partly because I have a daughter named Esther, so Mordecai I feel a little kinship with. But today, would you accept the challenge that Mordecai lays out in front of us? God wants to use you. Who, me? Yeah. You, today. If something about today's message has touched your heart, it would be good for you to talk to somebody about it. So I'm going to stay here for a few minutes after the service, and I would be more than happy to speak with you about it. Our leadership will be available. They'll speak with you about it. And you know what? I'm sure the person sitting right next to you, even if you don't know them, would be willing to hear what God is doing in your spirit. So make sure you share that with somebody today. Otherwise, I pray that God would bless you and that he would keep you this week. We love you. We really do. You're loved. And hopefully we'll see you here next week as Leanne shares. Have a wonderful week.